The Right Question is funded by the Steele Reese Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
How do you come up with the opening lines of your stories?
The opening line is really important to me. Most of the time when I'm on panels and I'm talking to people, what I learn is that the opening line is usually something they discover like into the third or fourth draft or on page 20. And people will just kind of write into a story and just keep writing till they find the beginning. And I think I'm the only writer I know of who has to have the opening line first, and the opening line almost never changes. I don't know why I tend to work that way, but that is the way I work. So I come up with opening lines by just sort of, I'll think of a character in a situation, and I'll kind of stew on it until a line comes to me. And with the line, usually there's a character and there's a situation that gets introduced. So that's typically how I come up with an opening line. But when I was writing these stories, one thing I did a little bit different was there were some nights when I was staying up all night to write in bed next to my wife, and she'd be sort of half falling asleep, and I would say, "Give me an opening line. I don't care what it is. Just give me a line, anything." And so I'd get her up out of this half awake state, and she'd just say something, and I'd say, "Okay." And I'd take that and make it be my opening line and improvise from that into a story. So there are two or three stories in here that I have to credit her with the opening line. The funny thing is she'll have something else in mind behind the line, and I don't want to hear it. Like, she'll say, no, just the line. And then later on she'll tell me what she had in her head, and it's nothing at all like the story that I'll come up with.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features writers from the Western United States. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Gregory Spatz about his collection of stories titled Half as Happy. Well, one of the best opening lines, in my opinion, happens in the story titled A Bear for Trying, which goes like this. He just needed to get rid of all the little animals super glued to his dashboard. I'm almost afraid to ask where this one came from.
That was actually one that my wife gave me. She has a really good imagination. She came up with that, and I was like, yeah, that sounds really good. And wow. I went from there.
So tell us about that story, who this guy is, how did the animals get there, and why is he reluctant to try to remove them?
I think in the story itself, by the end of it, you get the sense that he doesn't want to remove those animals because he feels as if they've cast some kind of spell on him that has to do with his losing his twin brother, basically. And he loses his twin brother through his own acts of stupidity and stealing his brother's girlfriend, more or less.
And the brother has moved away.
Yeah, and the brother's moved away. He's not dead, but for all purposes, he's dead to the main character. And it's a twin brother, so it's a huge loss. The animals got there from the two of them making bets and carrying on and being really immature and doing stupid things together. And in commemoration of each stupid act, they glue an animal onto the dashboard of his truck. And they do this for a spring and a summer together, and then shortly thereafter is when the bad stuff happens and the twin brother leaves town. And where this came from in my own life sadly has something to do with my older son, who is sort of, this is very, very loosely based on him, but he'd gotten his first tattoos, and I was kind of responding to that. He likes to kind of goof off a lot. So I was getting his sort of sense of driftlessness, but also his intense loyalty to his brother. I mean, even though he does this stupid thing, which destroys the connection between the two of them, he's really loyal to him. Like, he loves him like nobody else. And it's only by losing him that he learns that.
And there's also a little bit of a theme of loss of stability. And I think the character says something like, people who don't have stability in their life tend to believe in things like astrology and right. other non-confirmable things.
Right, and he's fully aware that his superstitious attachment to the animals is easily explained as one of these sort of beliefs that you grab onto when everything's gone wrong in your life. He knows that, but it doesn't matter. He still believes that he'd better not touch them. But then he's also just kind of lazy. I mean, there are a lot of things in his life that he should fix or he should take care of, and he doesn't just because it's too much trouble and he forgets about it. And then he remembers and then he forgets again. And that's why he's a little overweight and out of shape. And that's why his relationship with the girlfriend that he stole doesn't work out. And it's kind of why his life is the way it is.
I thought that the Bowmaker's Cats contained one of the most vivid descriptions of bad breath I've ever read or heard about. And I would like you to just read that.
Sure, let me just find that. And as he talked, the more he talked and talked, we were persistently aware that one of his teeth was rotten, hidden there inside his head somewhere and undeniably rotten, possibly abscessed. The smell of it, heavy, boozy, like rotten cabbage or sausage, some kind of funky old meat, stampeded us in wafts, solid seeming with the humidity of his breath and spit, and other odors having to do with the digestion of his lunch. The direction, timing, and relative velocity of his exhalations were not easy to predict, each one's movement unseeable in the surrounding air. Try as we might, angling heads and shifting back a step or to the side, the occasional full face collision with one was inevitable.
As I said. Well, let's have you read one of these stories. String part of it.
Yeah, it's too long to read the entire thing. String. We were not bad kids. We'd never stolen candy bars, tormented insects, or smaller children, drowned cats. Our worst crime the previous summer, breaking into the Cassidy's backyard to float in their pool on a moonlit night and imagine one or all of the pretty young sisters who lived there coming out to join us, or leaning from the windows of the upper story bedrooms with their hair down and the straps of their nightgowns falling away. Only their empty bathing suits on the line by the pool smelling faintly of powder and chlorine. Their shadows on the moonlit grass exciting in our imaginations two vivid images of the bodies that would fill them later the same day, bore witness to the innocence of our transgressions. We never smoked our uncle's cigarettes or cigars, never stole his whiskey or absinthe, never drove his pickup truck through the back pasture looking for sleeping cows to tip or to detonate, though all of these things and more were activities considered and rejected. Once, another night not long after the swimming pool incident, we rode his dinghy into the middle of the pond to cool off and then took turns scaring each other, standing up and causing the thing to rock wildly, until, in fact, it capsized and we found ourselves suddenly waist-deep in murky pond water and sinking, trying to flip the boat back over. But, aside from this, we were not bad kids. Quiet, obedient, mostly honor roll students at home, no one you'd look twice at. Not brothers exactly, but close enough. Our sister mothers had once nearly married the same man, unbeknownst to each other, and both wound up pregnant. The rest, as they say, is history. Meanwhile, the man, our mutual father, has not been seen or heard from since the day he learned he'd managed to more or less simultaneously impregnate that pair of sisters. He must have fled the state in panicked embarrassment, possibly some terror relating to our grandfather, who is very much alive then. Sometimes we think we've spotted him in a shopping mall outside town, and once or twice on the coast. Always our mothers are quick to say we're wrong. No, him. Not even close. That man? You must be kidding. The wholesome summer months without mothers in the heat of the upstate woods where they had spent their girlhoods, our mothers must have envisioned as some kind of corrective to their own failings as parents, a way to impose a little paternal masculinity, maybe, and rudder us back to the rustic lifestyle from which they'd so long ago defected. Give them a bit of backbone, they'd tell our uncle, their brother, dropping us off. A little agrarian thrift. Teach them to hoe a row and saddle the pony, set a trap. Survival skills, God knows they'll need them. Let them get good and dirty and cook on an open fire. Go barefoot, square dance, steal stuff. that kind of thing. Yeah, 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 our country uncle would say to them, like you ever cared about any of that before. To the best of our knowledge, they had never, since our father's disappearance, shared another man or even dated, period. Their brother, our country uncle, was the closest thing you might say we all had to a shared male influence anymore. But aside from the occasional early morning fishing jaunt, Uncle Mason had no real interest in any of the activities prescribed for us by our mothers, and not much interest in us, period. Days he spent at his insurance company in town, weekends and evenings he was in the workshop out back yowling curses and building his bad guitars and ukuleles from bubinga and exotic fruitwoods of most uncooperative grain and rarest origins. Have you read that book about Eric Clapton's guitar? He'd ask if we came anywhere in sight or earshot. Yeah, well, you should go read it again. Ignored and left to our own devices, we took turns swinging in the hammock, mixing pitchers of Kool-Aid and batches of Jell-O, eating pre-cooked frozen dinners and pizzas, and telling stories to scare the crap out of each other or to get each other all riled up over nothing. Girls we lusted after and fantasized about. Long dead people prying up floorboards and coming after us, clawing their way over the lawn, chasing us through the woods with clubs and bats into the attics of abandoned old neighbor houses. Which is more or less how the myth of the flaming ghost in the road ever got started. There was no local mythology attached to her, no ancient folklore type narrative. One of us saw her in a dream and remembered hearing of her from some older kids at school who'd played the same prank, but differently. By the time you see her, it's too late, rising in the light of your high beams like a headless flaming little witch, arms beckoning you on. No, like a little bloody white rabbit, someone strung up on a line and lit on fire. You see her and you know it's too late. Bada bing, bada boobinga, you're a dead man. And on rainy days, backgammon in the musty library, books and more books and endless games of solitaire when the heat was too much, and when we could no longer bear another minute's silence in each other's company, the grandfather clock sawing out the boards of eternity tick by monotonous tick in the background, when some form of physical release was positively required, lame tennis matches on Mason's weed-festooned clay court, whacking at each other tennis balls so dead and bald they looked more like mushrooms than any kind of sporting goods. Hit hard enough, one would occasionally pop wide, emitting an eggy smell of rubberized glue, ancient pine needles, and chilly spring rain. You could say it was her fault, Ms. Flaming Ghost in the Road. Certainly that was how we thought of it, because once we decided it was our job to make her real again, everything was out of our hands. Like she was telling us how it should be done, and giving us all necessary instructions, the angle of the sunset and time of day, which telephone pole to string her from, and how much to bunch her at the top like a thing with a severed head. Where to smear her with currant jelly and motor oil. You could say we had no part in it, really, once the plan was in motion. And then, at the sound of the car approaching, the fated moment bearing down, both of us knowing simultaneously it would work. I was on signal duty, closer to the road and watching, arm up, ready to wave, when? Pete, 10 paces back in the woods, string in hand. Headlights reflected on the leaves overhead. Light in the asphalt. Motor coming closer, a chirp in the engine noise audible now. A radio playing, tires on gravel, fan belt clacking, and then the moment. Down went my arm. Pete yanked her line, and up she flew, alive, floating into the headlights, so real and bloody I thought I heard her scream. And then, taillight stabbing half-darkness, groaning sound of tires on gravel and gravel sliding away, shattering glass and underbrush, the groaning noise of metal scraped into and colliding against something final, tree stump, boulder. Both of us again looking at each other and knowing we had done something finally really terribly wrong, terribly and irrevocably wrong, and then we were running.
You You've been listening to Gregory Spatz read from String, which is one of the stories in his collection titled Half as Happy. There's more information about the book at our blog, located at therightquestion.blogspot.com. Be sure to spell right with a W. This is The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman. After a short break, we'll continue our conversation. Stay tuned. Short stories really had a heyday for a while. You know, a few decades ago, they were published in lots and lots of magazines. And do you think short stories are making a comeback now?
It's really interesting. I feel like short stories kind of went underground in a way that happens when people ignore something artistic. I don't think they ever went away or died or anything like that, because the quarterlies have been publishing great work right along. And really good books of short stories have come out and have launched people's careers. Nathan Englander wouldn't be known for the writer that he is if it wasn't for his short story collection that launched his career. I mean, every now and then people will decide, or Kevin Brockmeyer, the same thing, and who else was like that? Juno Diaz. I mean, so many people built their careers off of a first book of short stories. And for whatever reason, the publishing industry will decide this one will launch so-and-so's career, and it does. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know the answer to that question, but it does. It sort of seems like we're at the whims of people who decide what they can and can't sell. And this year, all of a sudden, for some unknown reason, people have decided, hey, we can sell short stories after all. And so there are all these books that have come out and people are like, hey, the short story's back. Well, it never went away. It's just a matter of where reviewers and marketing people and publicists are choosing to focus their attention. I think it was 2 or 3 weeks ago I opened up the New York Times book review and there were like 5 story collections being reviewed. And I was just gobsmacked. I was like, I don't think I've ever seen this since maybe 20 years ago. And it's great. I have no explanation for it aside from what I just said, that just sort of it's the whims of the market.
I thought maybe it was people's shorter attention spans. The short story is the tweet of the literary world, maybe.
And that could be. People have been saying that right along all the way through the 90s and the earlier part of the 2000s, whatever, what do you call that? People have been saying that right along. We should love short stories because we have such a short attention span. They're perfect. What's the problem? Why do publishers keep saying I can't sell them? Well, it seems like they should be absolutely sellable. So,
well, as a book, when you sit down with a collection of short stories, you're not going to curl up on the couch and read from beginning to end, or read, you know, you just can't put it down because maybe you can't put that one short story down, but when that short story ends, they're so densely packed with stuff to think about that when I'm done with a short story, I need to put that book down for a while and think about it, especially if it's a really good one.
Well, you're a really good reader. I mean, I think that is really the best way that you could read a short story collection, is to really give your attention to one and let it kind of unfold in your mind and then walk away and read the next one. Unless they're linked stories, which, you know, in that case, reading them close together will augment your experience rather than diminish it. There are ways, some story collections are constructed in a way that there are deliberate echoes and connections between the stories that if you walked away from it for too long, you miss that and you won't get that added experience. There's a book by Haruki Murakami that I really love, particularly for that reason, that it's called After the Quake. And it's important that you read it all the way through without taking much breaks between the story, because the ending lines are usually tied to the opening lines of the next story. And they're images that recur, and it really messes with your head in a good way. It's one of my favorite books for that reason.
In the title story of the collection, which is Half as Happy, there's a scene in which the main character is wondering about his wife's desire for freedom and thinking that she doesn't really want freedom as much as she, as you write, quote, wants to want it or wants to think of herself as a person wanting it. So what did you find out about personal freedom during the process of writing this story?
Well, I think that what the main thing that I was thinking about in regard to freedom and personal freedom is sort of tied with identity and how your identity changes over the course of your life, and especially over the course of a marriage. And a marriage has to be big enough to contain multiple versions of identity. And identity is always situational. You are one person to your colleagues, you're another person to your students, you're another person at home, you're another person to your kids, you're another person at the store. I mean, depending on who you're talking to, you literally have a different identity. And so in this case, we have a main character whose his wife is her fixed point of identity is kind of hard to pin down, which is probably why he's with her in the first place. And it's part of how he's managed to continue being in love with her or continue being interested in her for all these years. She's gone through many transformations in the past. And in this case, the transformation involves her losing a lot of weight to the point where he starts thinking it's dangerous. And in some ways, she's almost trying to erase herself or trying to prove that she's never actually been there. And I think the way he's understanding her relationship to being a married person and to having these multiple identities and sort of straining against how people perceive her and trying to be free at the same time. And I think we all have that in our lives. We have to inhabit this kind of paradoxical state of wanting to be in a sort of unlimited way, really, really free, but we also can't ever. We're caught in ourselves and we're caught in our commitments and our responsibilities in our lives and want to be. If you were totally adrift, it's not a good thing. The existentialists kind of proved that to us.
In order to know what you want to be free from.
Right. So, I mean, the whole story is just sort of a meditation on all of those questions in the context of a marriage. That was probably the hardest story in there for me to write. It was always vivid to me visually, and then finding where the story was and where the narrative was all the way through it was really tricky.
I really liked the scene where Stan was watching the Jimmy Stewart movie and thinking of himself as Jimmy Stewart.
Right, and that's the same thing where it's like, who is he? What's his identity? And in some ways, his identity, he actually is Jimmy Stewart. He becomes Jimmy Stewart. And I think I stole that a little bit from the Jane Smiley novella, The Age of Grief, where you have that. I don't know if you've read it, but it's one of my favorite pieces of hers. And there's a dentist who is convinced that his wife is having an affair. And somewhere in the middle of the piece, he becomes inhabited by one of his patients. Like, he takes on his persona and he takes on his voice and he starts cussing out his kids and he starts cussing out his wife and he's really behaving out of character. And he's been inhabited by this other person. And it's like, that's so cool. So I stole that a little bit in having my character sort of think of himself as Jimmy Stewart. I think it also helps you to get a visual for him. Because everyone knows what Jimmy Stewart was like in that movie.
So what makes you write short stories?
I think it's basically it's the thing that compels me to write anything, and it takes the form of a short story if it feels like the idea and the characters and the situation are appropriate to that length and that form, which means I can kind of see my way in and out more quickly, or the problem is confined and limited and focused enough that it could be done in 8,000 words or 11,000 words or 6,000 words, as opposed to, you know, 100 or 60,000. Writing a short story is much more liberating in a way than writing a novel, because you know that you can get out of it. You know you can be done with it. A novel feels much more like a big long-term commitment, and you're going to have to be there, what, you know, on days when you don't like it and then days when you do like it, and when it's going well and when it's not going well. And you're committing to a style, you're committing to a tone, you're committing to a set of characters, you're committing to a world, and you're going to live with it for years. So it's a very different space to inhabit imaginatively. And stories are just a little bit more liberating because you know you're going to be on to the next one soon. And they also give you a little more opportunity for artistic growth, because between each story, you can work out all the ideas you had about a certain subject or set of characters and move on to the next thing. And everything you learned from that story, you can apply it to the next one. So it's a great form to use as you're developing, and it's a great form to continue to develop as you're writing. I think you get better and better faster by writing lots of stories.
Yay. That's encouraging for people who are writing stories.
I just love short stories. And there's no one should ever think that they're easy or that they're slight or they're second to the novel. They're just different. And they take an extreme intense focus. And they're almost impossible, I think, to ever do well or do right.
It's one of those forms that I read, and when I'm done with it, I either go, wow, that was a really good story, or I go, eh.
What happened?
What, did you just get tired of this and stop writing? I'm not saying that about any of your stories.
I think you're right. I mean, I feel like that is the risk with the story, is like there's a point. It's that sort of critical mass point. And there are a lot of stories that I'll read that are published where you start to see where it's going on, you know, about a half or two-thirds of the way through the story, and there's no more surprises left. And those are usually the stories, or you begin to see how the big central idea is gonna drive the end of the story. And those are the ones that you get done and you're like, ah, what was that for? But it's the ones that do something else at the end where you're just like, you're knocked off your feet. Those are the ones that can do something that a novel can't do. And that's pretty cool.
Gregory Spatz lives in Spokane, Washington, where he teaches in the MFA program at the Inland Northwest Center for Writers. Look for more information about him at therightquestion.blogspot.com, as well as book reviews, poetry, and links to our podcast and Facebook page.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau, Lisa Simon, David Moore, and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. You'll find links to author information, audio, and our Facebook and podcast feeds at therightquestion.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.